chapter 11 of the Kabbalion, Rhythm. The great fifth Hermetic principle, the principle of rhythm, embodies the truth that in everything there is a manifested, a measured motion, a to and from movement, a flow and inflow, a swing forward and backward, a pendulum-like movement, a tide-like ebb and flow, a high tide and a low tide between the two poles manifest on the physical, mental, or spiritual planes. The principle of rhythm is closely connected with the principle of polarity described in the preceding chapter. Rhythm manifests between the two poles established by the principle of polarity. This does not mean, however, that the pendulum of rhythm swings to the extreme poles, for this rarely happens. In fact, it is difficult to establish the extreme polar opposites in the majority of cases. But the swing is ever toward first one pole and then the other. There's always an action and reaction, an advance and a retreat, a rising and sinking, manifested in all of the airs and phenomena of the universe. Suns, worlds, men, animals, plants, minerals, forces, energy, mind, and matter, yes, even spirit, manifests this principle. The principle manifests in the creation and destruction of worlds, and the rise and fall of nations, and the life history of all things, and finally into the mental states of man. Beginning with the manifestations of the spirit of the all, it will be noticed that there is ever the outpouring and the indrawing, the outbreathing and inbreathing of Brahm, as the Brahmins word it. Universes are created, reach their extreme low point of materiality, and then begin in their upward swing. Suns spring into being, and then their height of power being reached, the process of retrogression begins. After aeons, they become dead masses of matter, awaiting another impulse which starts again their inner energies into activity, and a new solar life cycle is begun. And thus it is with all the worlds. They are born, grow, and die, only to be reborn. And thus it is with all the things of shape and form. They swing from action to reaction, from birth to death, from activity to inactivity, and then back again. Thus it is with all living things. They are born, grow, and die, and then are reborn. So it is with all great movements, philosophies, creeds, fashions, governments, nations, and all else: birth, growth, maturity, decadence, death, and then new birth. The swing of the pendulum is ever in evidence. Night follows day and day night. The pendulum swings from summer to winter and then back again. The corpuscles, atoms, molecules, and all masses of matter swing around the circle of their nature. There is no such thing as absolute rest or cessation from movement. All movement partakes of rhythm. The principle is of universal application. It may be applied to any question or phenomenon of any of the many planes of life. It may be applied to all phases of human activity. There is always the romantic swing from one pole to the other. The universal pendulum is ever in motion. The tides of life flow in and out according to law. The principle of rhythm is well understood by modern science, and it is considered a universal law as applied to material things. But the Hermeticists carry the principle much further and know that its manifestations and influence extend to the mental activities of man, and that it accounts for the bewildering succession of moods, feelings, and other annoying and perplexing changes that we notice in ourselves. But the Hermeticists, by studying the operations of this principle, have learned to escape some of its activities by transmutation. The Hermetic masters long since discovered that while the principle of rhythm was invariable and ever in evidence in mental phenomena, still there were two planes of its manifestation so far as mental phenomena are concerned. They discovered that there were two general planes of consciousness, the lower and the higher, the understanding of which fact enabled them to rise to the higher plane and thus escape the swing of the rhythmic pendulum, which manifested on the lower plane. In other words, the swing of the pendulum occurred on the unconscious plane, and the consciousness was not affected. This they call the law of neutralization. Its operations consist in the raising of the ego above the vibrations of the unconscious plane of mental activity so that the negative swing of the pendulum is not manifested in consciousness. And therefore, they are not affected. It is akin to rising above a thing and letting it pass beneath you. The hermetic master or advanced student polarizes himself at the desired pole and by a process akin to refusing to participate in the backward swing, or if you prefer, a denial of its influence over him, he stands firm in his polarized position and allows the mental pendulum to swing back along the unconscious plane. All individuals who have attained any degree of self-mastery accomplish this, more or less, unknowingly. And by refusing to allow their moods and negative mental states to affect them, they apply the law of neutralization. The master, however, carries this to a much higher degree of proficiency. And by the use of his will, he attains a degree of poise and mental firmness almost impossible of belief on the part of those who allow themselves to be swung backward and forward by the mental pendulum of moods and feelings. The importance of this will be appreciated by any thinking person who realize what creatures of moods, feelings, and emotion the majority of people are and how little mastery of themselves they manifest. If you will stop and consider a moment, you will realize how much these swings of rhythm have affected you in your life. How a period of enthusiasm has been invariably followed by an opposite feeling of mood and of depression. Likewise, your moods and periods of courage have been succeeded by equal moods of fear. And so it has ever been with the majority of persons. Tides of feelings have ever risen and fallen with them, but they have never suspected the cause or reason of the mental phenomena. An understanding of the workings of this principle will give one the key to the mastery of these rhythmic swings of feeling, and will enable him to know himself better and to avoid being carried away by these inflows and outflows. The will is superior to the conscious manifestation of this principle, although the principle itself can never be destroyed. We may escape its effects, but the principle operates nevertheless. The pendulum ever swings, although we may escape being carried along with it. There are other features of the operation of this principle of rhythm which we wish to speak of at this point. There comes into its operations that which is known as the law of compensation. One of the definitions or meanings of the word compensate is to counterbalance, which is the sense in which the Hermeticists use the term. It is this law of compensation to which the Kabbalion refers when it says, quote, "The measure of the swing to the right is the measure of the swing to the left. Rhythm compensates." The law of compensation is that the swing in one direction determines the swing in the opposite direction, or to the opposite pole, the one balances or counterbalances the other. On the physical plane, we see many examples of this law. The pendulum of the clock swings a certain distance to the right and then an equal distance to the left. The seasons balance each other in the same way. The tides follow the same law, and the same law is manifested in all the phenomena of rhythm. The pendulum with a short swing in one direction has but a short swing in the other, while the long swing to the right invariably means the long swing to the left. An object hurled upward to a certain height has an equal distance to traverse on its return. The force with which a projectile is sent upward a mile is reproduced when the projectile returns to Earth on its return journey. This law is constant on the physical plane, as reference to the standard authorities will show you. But the Hermeticists carry it still further. They teach that a man's mental states are subject to the same law. The man who enjoys keenly is subject to keen suffering, while he who feels but little pain is capable of feeling but little joy. The pig suffers but little mentally and enjoys but little, he is compensated. And on the other hand, there are other animals who enjoy keenly, but whose nervous organism and temperament cause them to suffer exquisite degrees of pain, and so it is with man. There are temperaments which permit of but low degrees of enjoyment, and actually low degrees of suffering. while there are others which permit the most intense enjoyment, but also the most intense suffering. The rule is that the capacity for pain and pleasure in each individual are balanced. The law of compensation is in full operation here. But the Hermeticists still go further into this matter. They teach that before one is able to enjoy a certain degree of pleasure, he must have swung as far proportionately toward the other pole of feeling. They hold, however, that the negative is precedent to the positive in this matter. That is to say that in experiencing a certain degree of pleasure, it does not follow that he will have to pay up for it with a corresponding degree of pain. On the contrary, the pleasure is the rhythmic swing according to the law of compensation. For a degree of pain is previously experienced either in the present life or in a previous incarnation. This throws new light on the problem of pain. The Hermeticists regard the chain of lives as continuous, as forming a part of one life of the individual, so that in consequence, the rhythmic swing is understood in this way, while it would be meaningless unless the truth of reincarnation is admitted. But the Hermeticists claim that the master or advanced student is able, to a great degree, to escape the swing toward pain by the process of neutralization before mentioned. By rising on to the higher plane of the ego, much of the experience that comes to those dwelling on the lower plane is avoided and escaped. The law of compensation plays an important part in the lives of men and women. It will be noticed that one generally pays the price of anything he possesses or lacks. If he has one thing, he lacks another. The balance is struck. No one can keep his penny and have the bit of cake. Yeah, you can't have your cake and eat it too. God, that's, we could just get women to ever learn that, the world would be just such a better place. God, what is it with women? Every goddamn one of them, they want to have their cake and eat it too. At the same time, everything has its pleasant and unpleasant sides. The things that one gains are always paid for by things that one loses. The rich possess much that the poor lack, while the poor often possess things that are beyond the reach of the rich. The millionaire may have the inclination toward feasting and the wealth wherewith to secure all the dainties and luxuries of the table. While he lacks the appetite to enjoy the same, he envies the appetite and digestion of the laborer who lacks the wealth and inclinations of the millionaire, and who gets more pleasure from his plain food than the millionaire could obtain from, even if his appetite were not jaded, nor his digestion ruined, for the wants, habits, and inclinations differ. And so it is through life. The law of compensation is ever in operation, striving to balance and counterbalance, and always succeeding in time, even though several lives may be required for the return swing of the pendulum of rhythm. And that's the end of chapter 11 there. The next chapter is chapter 12, causation. The great sixth hermetic principle, the principle of cause and effect, embodies the truth that law pervades the universe. That nothing happens by chance, that chance is merely a term indicating cause existing but not recognized or perceived, that phenomena is continuous without break or exception. The principle of cause and effect underlies all scientific thought, ancient and modern, and was enunciated by the Hermetic teachers in the earliest days. While many and varied disputes between the many schools of thought have since arisen, since arisen, these disputes have been principally upon the details of the operations of the principle, and still more often upon the meaning of certain words. The underlying principle of cause and effect has been accepted as correct by practically all the thinkers of the world worthy of the name. To think otherwise would be to take the phenomenon of the universe from the domain of law and order and to relegate it to the control of the imaginary something which men have called chance. A little consideration will show anyone that there is in reality no such thing as pure chance. Webster defines the word chance as follows: a supposed agent or mode of activity other than a force, law, or purpose. The operation or activity of such agent, a supposed effect of such an agent, a happening a fortuity, a casualty, etc. But a little consideration will show anyone that there is in reality no such thing as pure chance. There's no such thing, there's no such agent as chance in the sense of something outside of law, something outside of cause and effect. How could there be a something acting in the phenomenal universe independent of the laws, order, and continuity of the latter? That's a good point. You say, oh, that's a coincidence. No, there are no coincidences. Such a something would be entirely independent of the orderly trend of the universe and therefore superior to it. We can imagine nothing outside of the all being outside of the law, and that only because the law, the all, is the law itself. There is no room in the universe for a something outside of and independent of law. The existence of such a, of something would render all natural laws ineffective and would plunge the universe into chaotic disorder and lawlessness. A careful examination will show that what we call chance is merely an expression relating to obscure causes, causes that we cannot perceive, causes that we cannot understand. The word chance is derived from a word meaning to fall, as in the falling of dice. The idea being that the fall of the dice are merely a happening unrelated to any cause. And this is the sense in which the term is generally employed. But when the matter is closely examined, it is seen that there is no chance whatsoever about the fall of the dice. Each time a dice falls and it displays a certain number, it obeys a law as infallible as that which governs the revolution of the planets around the sun. Back of the fall of the dice are causes, or chains of causes, running back further than the mind can follow. The position of the dice in the box, the amount of muscular energy expended in the throw, the condition of the table, etc., etc., are all causes, the effect of which may be seen. But back of these seen causes, there are chains of unseen preceding causes, all of which had a bearing upon the number of the dice which fell uppermost. If a dice be cast a great number of times, it will be found that the numbers shown will be about equal. That is, there will be an equal number of one spot, two spot, etc., coming uppermost. Toss a penny in the air, and it may come down either heads or tails. But make a sufficient number of tosses, and the heads and tails will about even up. This is the operation of the law of average. But both the average and the single toss come under the law of cause and effect. If we were able to examine the preceding causes, it would be clearly seen that it was simply impossible for the dice to fall other than it did under the same circumstances at the same time. Given the same causes, the same results will follow. There is always a cause and a because to every event. Nothing ever happens without a cause, or rather a chain of causes. Some confusion has arisen in the minds of persons considering this principle, from the fact that they were unable to explain how one thing could cause another thing, that is, and be the creator of the second thing. As a matter of fact, no thing ever causes or creates another thing. Cause and effect deals merely with events. An event is that which comes, arrives, or happens as a result of consequent of some preceding event. No event creates another event, but is merely a preceding link in the great orderly chain of events flowing from the creative energy of the all. There is a continuity between all events, precedent, consequent, and subsequent. There is a relation existing between everything that has gone before and everything that follows. A stone is dislodged from a mountainside and crashes through a roof of a cottage in the valley below. At first sight, we regard this as a chance effect. But when we examine the matter, we find a great chain of causes behind it. In the first place, there was the rain, which softened the earth, supporting the stone, and which allowed it to fall. Then back of that was the influence of the sun, other rains, etc., which gradually disintegrated the piece of rock from a larger piece. Then there were the causes which led to the formation of the mountain, and its upheaval by convulsions of nature, and so on ad infinitum. Then we might follow up the causes behind the rain, etc. Then we might consider the existence of the roof. In short, we would soon find ourselves involved in a mesh of cause and effect, from which we would soon strive to extricate ourselves. Just as a man has two parents and four grandparents and eight great-grandparents, and 16 great-great-grandparents, and so on until when we say 40 generations are calculated, the numbers of ancestors run into many millions. So it is with the number of causes behind even the most trifling event or phenomenon, such as the passage of a tiny speck of soot before your eye. It is not an easy matter to trace the bit of soot back to the early period of the world's history, when it formed a part of a massive tree trunk, which was afterward converted into coal and so on, until as the speck of soot, it now passes before your vision on its way to other adventures. And a mighty chain of events, causes, and effects brought it to its present condition. And the latter is but one of the chain of events which will go on to produce another event hundreds of years from now. One of the series of events arising from the tiny bit of soot was the writing of these lines, which caused the typewriter to perform certain work, and the proofreader to do likewise, and which will arouse certain thoughts in your mind and that of others, which in turn will affect others, and so on and so on and on, beyond the ability of man to think further and all from the passage of a tiny bit of soot, all of which shows the relativity and association of things, and the further fact that there is no great, there is no small, in the mind that causeth all. Stop to think a moment. If a certain man had not met a certain maid, away back in the dim period of Stone Age, you who are now reading these lines would not be here now. And if perhaps the same couple had failed to meet, we who now write these lines would now not be here. And the very act of writing on our part and the act of reading on yours will affect not only the respective lives of yourself and ourselves, but will also have a direct or indirect effect upon many other people now living and who will live in the ages to come. Every thought we think, every act we perform, has its direct and indirect results which fit into the great chain of cause and effect. We do not wish to enter into a consideration of free will or determinism in this work for various reasons. Among the many reasons is the principal one that neither side of the controversy is entirely right. In fact, both sides are partially right according to the Hermetic teachings. The principle of polarity shows that both are but half-truths, the opposing poles of truth. The teachings are that a man may be both free and yet bound by necessity, depending upon the meaning of the terms, and the height of truth from which the matter is examined. The ancient writers expressed the matter thus: the further the creation is from the center, the more it is bound. The nearer the center it reaches, the nearer free it is. The majority of people are more or less the slaves of heredity, environment, etc., and manifest very little freedom. They are swayed by the opinions, customs, and thoughts of the outside world, and also by their emotions, feelings, moods, etc. They manifest no mastery worthy of the name. They indignantly repudiate this assertion, saying, "Why, I certainly am free to act and do as I please. I do just what I want to do." But they fail to explain whence arise the want to and as I please. What makes them want to? What makes them want to do one thing in preference to doing another? What makes them please to do this and not do that? Is there no because to their pleasing and wanting? The master can change these pleases and wants into others at the opposite end of the mental pole. He is able to will, instead of to will because some feeling, mood, emotion, or environmental suggestion arouses a tendency or desire within him to do so. The majority of people are carried along like the falling stone, obedient to environment, outside influences, internal moods, desires, etc. Not to speak of the desires and wills of others stronger than themselves. Heredity, environment, and suggestion carry them along without resistance on their part or the exercise of the will. Moved like pawns on the checkerboard of life, they play their parts and are laid aside after the game is over. But the masters, knowing the rules of the game, rise above the plane of material life, and placing themselves in touch with the higher powers of their nature, dominate their own moods, characters, qualities, and polarity, as well as the environment surrounding them, and thus become movers in the game instead of pawns. Causes instead of effects. The masters do not escape the causation of the higher planes, but fall in with the higher laws and thus master circumstances on the lower plane. They thus form a conscious part of the law instead of being mere blind instruments. While they serve on the higher planes, they rule on the material plane. But on higher and on lower, the law is always in operation. There is no such thing as chance. The blind goddess has been abolished by reason. We are able to see now with eyes made clear by knowledge that everything is governed by universal law, that the infinite number of laws are but manifestations of the one great law, the law which is the all. It is true indeed that not a sparrow drops unnoticed by the mind of the all. That even the hairs on our head are numbered as the scriptures have said, and that there is nothing outside of the law, nothing that happens contrary to it. And yet, do not make the mistake of supposing that man is but a blind automaton. Far from it. The Hermetic teachings are that man may use law to overcome laws, and that the higher will always prevail against the lower, until at last he has reached the stage in which he seeks refuge in the law itself. And laughs the phenomenal laws to scorn. Are you able to grasp the inner meaning of this? If not, you're going to have to listen to this rebroadcast again. That's the end of chapter 12. Thank you so much. Let's get into chapter 13 tonight of the Kybalion, gender. The great seventh Hermetic principle, the principle of gender, embodies the truth that there is gender manifested in everything and that the masculine and feminine principles are ever present and active in all phases of phenomena. On each and every plane, at this point, we think it well to call your attention to the fact that gender, in its Hermetic sense, and sex, in the ordinary accepted use term, are not the same. The word gender is derived from the Latin root meaning to beget, to procreate, to generate, to create, to produce. A moment's consideration will show you that the word has a much broader and more general meaning than the term sex, the latter referring to the physical distinctions between male and female living things. Sex is merely a manifestation of gender on a certain plane of the great physical plane, the plane of organic life. We wish to impress this distinction upon your minds for the reason that certain writers who have acquired a smattering of the Hermetic philosophy have sought to identify this seventh Hermetic principle with wild and fanciful and often reprehensible theories and teachings regarding sex. The office of gender is solely that of creating, producing, generating, etc., and its manifestations are visible on every plane of phenomena. It is somewhat difficult to produce proofs of this along scientific lines for the reason that science has not as yet recognize this principle as of universal application. But still, some proofs are forthcoming from scientific sources. In the first place, we find a distinct manifestation of the principle of gender among the corpuscles, ions, or electrons, which constitute the basis of matter as science now knows the latter, and which by forming certain combinations form the atom, which until lately was regarded as final and indivisible. The latest word of science is that the atom is composed of a multitude of corpuscles, electrons, or ions, revolving around each other and vibrating at a high degree in intensity. But the accompanying statement is made that the formation of the atom is really due to the clustering of negative corpuscles around a positive one, the positive one seeming to exert a certain influence upon the negative, causing the latter to assume certain combinations and thus create or generate an atom. This is in line with the most ancient Hermetic teachings, which have always identified the masculine principle of gender with the positive and the feminine with the negative poles of electricity. Now, a word at this point regarding this identification. The public mind has formed an entirely erroneous impression regarding the qualities of the so-called negative pole or electrified magnetized matter. The terms positive and negative are very wrongly applied to this phenomenon by science. The word positive means something real and strong as compared with a negative unreality or weakness. Nothing is further from the real facts of electrical phenomenon. The so-called negative pole of the battery is really the pole in, and by which the generation or production of new forms or energies is manifested. There is nothing negative about it. The best scientific authorities now use the word cathode in place of negative. The word cathode, coming from the Greek root word meaning descent, the path of generation, etc. From the cathode pole emerges the swarm of electrons. From the same pole emerge these wonderful rays, which have revolutionized scientific conceptions during the past decade. The cathode pole is the mother of all the strange phenomena which have rendered useless the old textbooks, and which have caused many long-accepted theories to be relegated to the scrap pile of scientific speculation. The cathode or negative pole is the mother principle of electrical phenomena, and of the finest forms of matter as yet known to science. So you see, we are justified in refusing to use the term negative in our consideration of the subject, and in insisting upon substituting the word feminine for the old term. The facts of the case bear us out in this without taking the Hermetic teachings into consideration, and so we shall use the word feminine in the place of negative in speaking of that pole of activity. The latest scientific teachings are that the creative corpuscles or electrons are feminine. Science says they are composed of negative electricity. We say they are composed of feminine energy. A feminine electron becomes detached from, or rather leaves, a masculine electron and starts on a new career. It actively seeks a union with a masculine electron, being urged thereto by the natural impulse to create new forms of matter or energy. One writer goes so far as to use the term, it at once seeks of its own volition a union, etc. This detachment and uniting from the basis of the greater part of the activities of the chemical world, when the feminine electron unites with a masculine electron, a certain process is begun. The feminine particles vibrate rapidly under the influence of the masculine energy and circle rapidly around the latter. The result is the birth of a new atom. This new atom is really composed of a union of the masculine and feminine electrons, or corpuscles. But when the union is formed, the atom is a separate thing, having certain properties no longer manifesting the property of free electricity. The process of detachment or separation of the feminine electrons is called ionization. These electrons are the most active workers in nature's field. Arising from their unions or combinations, manifest the varied phenomenon of light, heat, electricity, magnetism, attraction, repulsion, chemical affinity, and the reverse and similar phenomena. And all this arises from the operation of the principle of gender on the plane of energy. The part of the masculine principle seems to be that of directing a certain inherent energy toward the feminine principle, and thus starting into activity the creative process. It's called, I'm a man, I have a penis, let's have sex and procreate, you know? That's what it is. That's a great way of describing a man right there. His masculine principle seems to be that of directing certain inherent energy towards the feminine principle. Yeah. We drool and our penises get hard and we get horny and we're like, vagina, 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 vagina. And that's what they mean by directing a certain inherent energy toward the feminine principle and thus starting into activity, the creative process. Yeah. But the feminine principle is the one always doing the active creative work. And this is so on all planes. And yet each principle is incapable of operative energy without the assistance of the other. In some of the forms of life, the two principles are combined in one organism. For that matter, everything in the organic world manifests both genders. There is always the masculine present in the feminine form and the feminine present in the masculine form as well. The Hermetic teachings include much regarding the operation of the two principles of gender and the production and manifestation of various forms of energy. But we do not deem it expedient to go into the detail regarding the same at this point because we are unable to back up the same with scientific proof for the reason that science has not yet progressed thus far, but the example we have given you of the phenomenon of the electrons will show you that science is on the right path and will also give you a general idea of the underlying principles. Some leading scientific investigators have announced their belief that in the formation of crystals, there was to be found something that corresponded to sex activity, which is another straw showing the direction the scientific winds are blowing. And each year will bring other facts to corroborate the correctness of the Hermetic principle of gender. It will be found that gender is in constant operation and manifestation in the field of inorganic matter and in the field of energy or force. Electricity is now generally regarded as the something into which all other forms of energy seem to melt or dissolve. The electrical theory of the universe is the latest scientific doctrine and is growing rapidly in popularity and general acceptance. And it thus follows that if we are able to discover in the phenomenon of electricity, even at the very root and source of its manifestations, a clear and unmistakable evidence of the presence of gender and its activities, we are justified in asking you to believe that science at last has offered proofs of the existence in all universal phenomena of the great Hermetic principle, the principle of gender. It is not necessary to take up your time with a well-known phenomenon of the attraction and repulsion of the atoms, the chemical affinity, the loves and hates of the atomic particles, the attraction cohesion between the molecules of matter. These facts are too well known to need extended comment from us, but have you ever considered that all of these things are manifestations of the gender principle? Can you not see that the phenomenon is on all fours with that of the corpuscles or electrons? And more than this, can you not see that the reasonables of the Hermetic teachings, which assert that the very law of gravitation, that strange attraction by reason of which all particles and bodies and matters in the universe tend toward each other, is but another manifestation of the principle of gender, which operates in the direction of attracting the masculine to the feminine energies and vice versa? We cannot offer you scientific proof of this at this time, but examine the phenomenon in the light of the Hermetic teachings on the subject and see if you have not a better working hypothesis than any offered by physical science. Submit all physical phenomena to the test, and you will discern the principle of gender ever in evidence. Let us now pass on to a consideration of the operation of the principle on the mental plane. Many interesting features are there awaiting examination. All right, let's get into chapter 1449 from the Kabbalion, Mental Gender. Students of psychology who have followed the modern trend of thought along the lines of mental phenomenon are struck by the persistence of the dual mind idea, which has manifested itself so strongly during the past 10 or 15 years, and which has given rise to a number of plausible theories regarding the nature and constitution of these two minds. The late Thomas J. Hudson attained great popularity in 1893 by advancing his well-known theory of the objective and subjective minds, which he held existed in every individual. Other writers have attracted almost equal attention by the theories regarding the conscious and subconscious minds, the voluntary and involuntary minds, the active and passive minds, etc., etc. The theories of the various writers differ from each other, but there remains the underlying principle of the duality of mind. The student of the Hermetic philosophy is tempted to smile when he reads and hears of these many new theories regarding the duality of mind, each school adhering tenaciously to its own pet theories and each claiming to have discovered the truth. The student turns back the pages of occult history, and away back in the dim beginnings of occult teachings, he finds references to the ancient Hermetic doctrine of the principle of gender. On the mental plane, the manifestation of mental gender, and examining further, he finds that the ancient philosophy took cognizance of the phenomenon of the dual mind and accounted for it by the theory of mental gender. This idea of mental gender can be explained in a few words to students who are familiar with the modern theories just alluded to. The masculine principle of mind corresponds to the so-called objective mind, conscious mind, voluntary mind, active mind, etc. And the feminine principle of mind corresponds to the so-called subjective mind, subconscious mind, involuntary mind, passive mind, etc. Of course, the Hermetic teachings do not agree with the many modern theories regarding the nature of the two phases of mind, nor does it admit many of the facts claimed for the two respective aspects. Some have said of the theories and claims being very far-fetched and incapable of standing the test of experiment and demonstration. We point to the phases of agreement merely for the purpose of helping the student to assimilate his previously acquired knowledge with the teachings of the Hermetic philosophy. Students of Hudson will notice that the statement at the beginning of the second chapter of the Law of Psychic Phenomenon, the mystic jargon of the Hermetic philosophers, discloses the same general idea, i.e. the duality of mind. If Dr. Hudson had taken the time and trouble to decipher a little of the mystic jargon of the Hermetic philosophy, he might have received much light upon the subject of the dual mind, but then perhaps his most interesting work might not have been written. Let us now consider the Hermetic teachings regarding mental gender. The Hermetic teachers impart their instruction regarding this subject by bidding their students examine the report of their consciousness regarding their self. The students are bidden to turn their attention inward upon the self dwelling within each. Each student is led to see that his consciousness gives him first a report of the existence of his self. The report is, I am. This, at first, seems to be the final words from the consciousness, but a little further examination discloses the fact that this I am may be separated or split into two distinct parts or aspects, which, while working in unison and in conjunction, yet, nevertheless, may be separated in consciousness. While at first there seems to be only an I existing, a more careful and closer examination reveals the fact that there exists an I and a me. These mental twins differ in their characteristics and nature, and an examination of their nature and the phenomena arising from the same will throw much light upon many of the problems of mental influence. Let us begin with a consideration of the me, which is usually mistaken for the I by the student until he presses the inquiry a little further back into the recesses of consciousness. A man thinks of his self in its aspect of me as being composed of certain feelings, tastes, likes, dislikes, habits, peculiar ties, characteristics, etc., all of which go to make up his personality or the self known to himself and others. He knows that these emotions and feelings change, are born and die away, are subject to the principle of rhythm and the principle of polarity, which take him from one extreme of feeling to another. He also thinks of the me as being certain knowledge gathered together in his mind and thus forming a part of himself. This is the me of man. But we have proceeded too hastily. The me of many men may be said to consist largely of their consciousness, of the body and their physical appetites, etc. Their consciousness being largely bound up with their bodily nature, they practically live there. Some men even go so far as to regard their personal apparel as a part of their me and actually seem to consider it a part of themselves. A writer has humorously said that men consist of three parts, soul, body, and clothes. These clothes-conscious people would lose their personality if divested of their clothing by savages upon the occasion of a shipwreck. That's funny. But even many who are not so closely bound up with the idea of personal raiment stick closely to the consciousness of their bodies being their me. They cannot conceive of a self independent of the body. Their mind seems to them to be practically a something belonging to their body, which in many cases indeed it is. Well, you know what, I think of that in terms of myself. I'm not tatted up by any means, but I have four tattoos. They're pretty small, but I have four tattoos on my body. And I heard somebody say one time that a tattoo is the way that the soul leaves its mark upon the body. And I thought that was an amazing way of putting it. You know, it's like, we're born into these bodies and we're born with what we get, whether we like it or not. and we're forced to deal with it, and that's it. And you know, now they're, you know, they're coming up with new ways to augment that, but you know, that's why people get tattoos and they, you know, have their hair a certain way or a certain color and will dress a certain way or in a certain style and things of that nature, because it's a way that, that sort of who they're, as what they're calling here is the I. And I would say that the I is the soul, and the me is, you know, the personality of the meat suit that the I is existing in. And so because a lot of our, of who we are, I mean, it's amazing. People, but that's one thing I know better than anything else is people. And people, we're so amazing because a big part, not completely who we are, but a big part of who we are is comprised of the personality of this soul that inhabits us. And, you know, the outward, I mean, that's, I'll be honest with you. That's how, I mean, I look at the mirror and I look at myself and I'm like, really? That's me? My, you know, my outward reflect, my outward appearance to me doesn't seem what my, it, what it's inside my head. You know what I mean? It's just strange. Like, really, that's what I look like. Okay. And so I think that that's why we do these things. That's why we get tattoos and piercings and, you know, we have our hair a certain way or anything else, because it's kind of a way that we augment this flesh suit that we're, that our soul is inhabiting. And, you know, for whatever reason, our souls don't feel that the current stock operating system properly reflects their who they really are. And so, you know, that's what we do in response to that. Because there's just no question, folks. We are spirits in the material world. We are energy trapped. You know, it's soul enslavement, spiritual bondage. We're trapped here in these bodies for a period of time. And death is not the end. Death is not the last thing, since the lights just don't go out and that's it. But why? Well, think about it. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. Right? That's a fact. Think about that. We're all energy. Every living thing has energy. It has a light in it. There's you know, the transhumanists, these guys have driven themselves crazy because they can reproduce every, you know, every element of a human, recreate a human, but they can't animate it. They can't get that spark, the soul, the life force to inhabit that body they've created. And energy can either be created or destroyed. It just changes forms. And these understanding of these other forms is in understanding how those realms operate and work, and being able to have a clear mental understanding of their functioning while in this dimension is another one of the big teachings and the big secrets of the mystery religions and the secret societies, etc. But as man rises in the scale of consciousness, he is able to disentangle his me from his idea of body, and is able to think of his body as belonging to the mental part of him. But even then, he is very apt to identify the me entirely with the mental states, feelings, etc., which he feels to exist within him. He is very apt to consider these internal states as identical with himself, instead of there being simply things produced by some part of his mentality and existing within him, of him, and in him, but still not himself. He sees that he may change these internal states of feelings by all effort of will, and that he may produce a feeling or a state of an exactly opposite nature. In the same way, and yet the same me exists. And so after a while, he's able to set aside these various mental states, emotions, feelings, habits, qualities, characteristics, etc., and other personal mental belongings, and he is able to set them aside in the not-me collection of curiosities and encumbrances, as well as valuable possessions. This requires much mental concentration and power of mental analysis on the part of the student. But still, the task is possible for the advanced student, and even those not so far advanced are able to see in the imagination how the process may be performed. After this laying aside process has been performed, the student will find himself in conscious possession of a self, which may be considered in its I and me dual aspects. The me will be felt to be a something mental in which thoughts, ideas, emotions, feelings, and other mental states may be produced. It may be considered as the mental womb, as the ancients styled it, capable of generating mental offspring. It reports to the consciousness as a me with latent powers of creation and generation of mental progeny of all sorts and kinds. Its powers of creative energy are felt to be enormous, but still, it seems to be conscious that it must receive some form of energy from either its I companion or else from some other I where it is able to bring into its mental creations. This consciousness brings with it a realization of an enormous capacity for mental work and creative ability. But the student soon finds that this is not all that which he finds within his inner consciousness. He finds that there exists a mental something which is able to will that the me act along certain creative lines and which is also able to stand aside and witness the mental creation. This part of himself he is taught to call his I. He is able to rest in its consciousness at will. He finds there not a consciousness of an ability to generate and actively create in the sense of the gradual process attendant upon mental operations, but rather a sense and consciousness of an ability to project an energy from I to the me, a process of willing that the mental creation begin and proceed. He also finds that the I is able to stand aside and witness the operations of the me's mental creation and generation. There is this dual aspect in the mind of every person. The I represents the masculine principle of mental gender. The me represents the female principle. The I represents the aspect of being. The me represents the aspect of becoming. You will notice that the principle of correspondence operates on this plane just as it does upon the great plane upon which the creation of universes is performed. The two are similar in kind, although vastly different in degree, as above, so below, as below, so above. These aspects of mind, the masculine and feminine principles, the I and the me, considered in connection with the well-known mental and psychic phenomenon, give the master key to these dimly known regions of mental operation and manifestation. The principle of mental gender gives the truth underlying the whole field of the phenomenon of mental influence. The tendency of the feminine principle is always in the direction of receiving impressions, while the tendency of the masculine principle is always in the direction of giving or expressing. The feminine principle has much more varied field of operation than has the masculine principle. The feminine principle conducts the work of generating new thoughts, concepts, ideas, including the work of the imagination. The masculine principle contents itself with the work of the will in its varied phases. And yet, without the active aid of the will of the masculine principle, the feminine principle is apt to rest content with generating mental images which are the result of impressions received from outside, instead of producing original mental creations. Persons who can give continued attention and thought to a subject actively employ both of the mental principles, the feminine in the work of the mental generation, and the masculine will in stimulating and energizing the creative portion of the mind. The majority of persons really employ the masculine principle, but little and are content to live according to the thoughts and ideas instilled into the me from the I of other minds. But it is not our purpose to dwell upon this phase of the subject, which may be studied from any good textbook upon psychology, with the key that we have given you regarding mental gender. The student of psychic phenomenon is aware of the wonderful phenomenon classified under the head of telepathy, thought transference, mental influence, suggestion, hypnotism, etc. Many have sought for an explanation of these varied phases of phenomenon under the theories of the various dual mind teachers. And in a measure, they are right. For there is clearly a manifestation of two distinct phases of mental activity. But if such students will consider these dual minds in the light of the Hermetic teachings regarding vibrations and mental gender, they will see that the long-sought-for key is at hand. In the phenomena of telepathy, it is seen how the vibratory energy of the masculine principle is projected toward the feminine principle of another person, and the latter takes the seed thought and allows it to develop into maturity. In the same way, suggestion and hypnotism operates. The masculine principle of the person giving the suggestion directs a stream of vibratory energy or willpower toward the feminine principle of the other person, and the latter accepting it makes it its own, and acts and thinks accordingly. An idea thus lodged in the mind of another person grows and develops, and in time is regarded as the rightful mental offspring of the individual. Whereas in reality, like the cuckoo egg placed in the sparrow's nest, where it destroys the rightful offspring and makes itself at home. The normal method is for the masculine and feminine principles in a person's mind to coordinate and act harmoniously in conjunction with each other. But unfortunately, the masculine principle in the average person is too lazy to act, and the display of willpower is too slight, and the consequence is that such persons are ruled almost entirely by the minds and wills of other persons, who they allow to do their thinking and willing for them. How few original thoughts or original actions are performed by the average person? Are not the majority of persons mere shadows and echoes of others having stronger wills or minds than themselves? Absolutely. The trouble is that the average person dwells almost altogether in his me consciousness and does not realize that he has such a thing as an I consciousness. He is polarized in his feminine principle of mind, and the masculine principle in which is lodged the will is allowed to remain inactive and not employed. The strong men and women of the world invariably manifest the masculine principle of will, and their strength depends materially upon this fact. Instead of living upon the impressions made upon their minds by others, they dominate their own minds by their will, obtaining the kind of mental images desired, and moreover, dominate the minds of others likewise. And in the same manner, look at the strong people, how they manage to implant their seed thoughts in the minds of the masses of the people, thus causing the latter to think thoughts in accordance with the desires and wills of the strong individuals. This is why the masses of people are such sheep-like creatures, never originating an idea of their own, nor using their own powers of mental activity. Amen to that. The manifestation of mental gender may be noticed all around us in everyday life. The magnetic persons are those who are able to use the masculine principle in the way of impressing their ideas upon others. The actor who makes people weep or cry as he wills is employing this principle. And so is the successful orator, statesman, preacher, writer, or other people who are before the public attention. This peculiar influence exerted by some people over others is due to the manifestation of mental gender. Along the vibrational lines above indicated, in this principle lies the secret of personal magnetism, personal influence, fascination, etc., as well as the phenomenon generally grouped under the name of hypnotism. The student who has familiarized himself with the phenomenon generally spoken of as psychic will have discovered the important part played in the said phenomenon by that force which science has styled suggestion, by which term is meant the process or method whereby an idea is transferred to or impressed upon the mind of another, causing the second mind to act in accordance therewith. A correct understanding of suggestion is necessary in order to intelligently comprehend the varied psychical phenomenon which suggestion underlies. But still more is a knowledge of vibration and mental gender necessary for the student of suggestion. For the whole principle of suggestion depends upon the principle of mental gender and vibration. It is customary for the writers and teachers of suggestion to explain that it is the objective or voluntary mind which makes the mental impression or suggestion upon the subjective or involuntary mind. But they do not describe the process or give us any analogy in nature whereby we may be more readily able to comprehend the idea. But if you will think of the matter in the light of the Hermetic teachings, you will be able to see that the energizing of the feminine principle by the vibratory energy of the masculine principle is in accordance to the universal laws of nature, and that the natural world affords countless analogies whereby the principle may be understood. In fact, the Hermetic teachings show that the very creation of the universe follows the same law. and that in all creative manifestations upon the planes of the spiritual, the mental, and the physical, there is always in operation this principle of gender, this manifestation of the masculine and the feminine principles. As above, so below. As below, so above. And more than this, when the principle of mental gender is once grasped and understood, the varied phenomenon of psychology at once becomes capable of intelligent classification and study, instead of being very much in the dark. The principle works out in practice because it is based upon the immutable universal laws of life. We shall not enter into an extended discussion of or description of the varied phenomenon of mental influence or psychic activity. There are many books, many of them quite good, which have been written and published on this subject of late years. The main facts stated in these various books are correct, although the several writers have attempted to explain the phenomenon by various pet theories of their own. The student may acquaint himself with these matters, and by using the theory of mental gender, he will be able to bring order out of chaos of conflicting theory and teachings, and may, moreover, readily make himself a master of the subject if he so be inclined. The purpose of this work is not to give an extended account of psychophenomenon, but rather to give the student a master key whereby he may unlock the many doors leading into the parts of the temple of knowledge which he may wish to explore. We feel that in this consideration of the teachings of the Kybalion, one may find an explanation which will serve to clear away many perplexing difficulties, a key that will unlock many doors. What is the use of going into detail regarding all of the many features of the psychic phenomenon and mental science provided we place in the hands of the student the means whereby he may acquaint himself fully regarding any phase of the subject which may interest him? With the aid of the Kybalion, one may go through any occult library anew, the old light from Egypt illuminating many dark pages and obscure subjects. That is the purpose of this book. We do not come expounding a new philosophy, but rather furnishing the outlines of a great world-old teaching, which will make clear the teachings of others, which will serve as a great reconciler of differing theories and opposing doctrines. Hermetic Axioms, Chapter 15, the final chapter of our reading of the series Kybalion. And we'll move on to another book. I've got a few I'm choosing from and deciding right now. I just don't know what my next pick is going to be for sure yet. But we'll get to that as soon as I make a decision. Chapter 15, Hermetic Axioms. The Hermetic teachings, while always having been kept securely locked up in the minds of the fortunate possessors thereof, and for reasons which we have already stated, were never intended to be merely stored away and secreted. The law of the use is dwelt upon in the teachings, as you may see by reference to the above quotation for the Kybalion, which states forcibly, "The possession of knowledge, unless accompanied by a manifestation and expression in action, is like the hoarding of precious metals, a vain and foolish thing. Knowledge, like wealth, is intended for use. The law of use is universal, and he who violates it suffers by reason of his conflict with natural forces. Knowledge without use and expression is a vain thing, bringing no good to its possessor or to the race. Beware of mental miserliness. Miserliness, and express into action that which you have learned. Study the axioms and aphorisms, but practice them also." We give below some of the more important Hermetic axioms from the Kybalion, with a few comments added to each. Make these your own and practice and use them, for they are not really your own until you have used them. To change your mood or mental state, change your vibration. One may change his mental vibrations by an effort of will and the direction of deliberately fixing the attention upon a more desirable state. Will directs the attention, and attention changes the vibration. Cultivate the art of attention, means of the will, and you have solved the secret of the mastery of moods and mental states. To destroy an undesirable rate of mental vibration, put into operation the principle of polarity and concentrate upon the opposite pole to that which you desire to suppress. Kill out the undesirable by changing its polarity. This is one of the most important of the Hermetic formulas. It is based upon true scientific principles. We have shown you that a mental state and its opposite were merely the two poles of one thing, and that by mental transmutation, the polarity might be reversed. This principle is known to modern psychologists who apply it to the use of breaking up of undesirable habits by bidding their students concentrate upon the opposite quality. If you are possessed of fear, do not waste time trying to kill out fear, but instead cultivate the quality of courage, and the fear will disappear. Well, exactly. I've spoken to that many times in my own experience from that I've had doing this radio show and getting out this information and doing that. That kind of, you know, sums up my transition from going from being, you know, sort of one of these people that was in the truth movement and the mainstream truth movement and Alex Jones listener and following all this stuff and existing in that realm of fear to then finding out about the CMP and deciding to have the courage to stand up and talk about that information and talk about the implications of it. Even though when I first started talking about it, nobody wanted to listen to me about it at all. And now, you know, it's become part of the nomenclature now, you know, thanks, you know, and largely to the work that I've done and other people have done, but it certainly was not a part of the mainstream nomenclature and part of the conversation in as far as the research community goes before I came along, and it is now. And because I had the courage to stand up over that, did away with all the fear and bullshit that I had of, you know, the New World Order and all this stuff, and turned it into the energy to try and get out the real truth of what it really is that we're up against. Because, you know, again, you know, we have been given a convoluted picture of who and what it really is that we're up against. And so up to this point, any action has fallen flat on its face, because we're fighting against a shadowy enemy that we believe is what we've identified it as. But we don't have all the facts yet, not any of us. Some writers have expressed this idea most forcibly by using the illustration of the dark room. You do not have to shovel out or sweep out the darkness, but by merely opening the shutters and letting in the light, darkness has disappeared. To kill out a negative quality, concentrate upon the positive pole of that same quality, and the vibrations will gradually change from negative to positive, until finally you will become polarized on the positive pole instead of the negative. The reverse is also true, as many have found out to their sorrow, when they have allowed themselves to vibrate too constantly on the negative pole of things. And our whole society is garnered towards getting people to dwell on the negative pole of things. And you get people you'll fall into that. And you just have to pull yourself out of that and not allow yourself to get in that. You know, something bad happens to you or something negative comes along, you know, dwelling in it and just, oh, woe is me, and feeling sorry for yourself just makes it worse. Doesn't help it. By changing your polarity, you may master your moods, change your mental states, remake your disposition, and build up character. Much of the mental mastery of the advanced hermetics is due to this application of polarity, which is one of the most important aspects of mental transmutation. Remember the hermetic axiom quoted previously, which says, mind as well as metals and elements may be transmuted from state to state, degree to degree, condition to condition, pole to pole, vibration to vibration. The mastery of polarization is the mastery of the fundamental principles of mental transmutation or mental alchemy. For unless one acquires the art of changing his own polarity, he will be unable to affect his environment. An understanding of this principle will enable one to change his own polarity as well as that of others. If he will but devote the time, care, study, and practice necessary to master the art. The principle is true, but the results obtained depend upon the persistent patience and practice of the student. Rhythm may be neutralized by an application of the art of polarization. As we have explained in previous chapters, the Hermeticists hold that the principle of rhythm manifests on the mental plane as well as on the physical plane, and that the bewildering succession of moods, feelings, emotions, and other mental states are due to the backward and forward swing of the mental pendulum, which carries us from one extreme of feeling to the other. The Hermeticists also teach that the law of neutralization enables one, to a great extent, to overcome the operation of rhythm in consciousness. As we have explained, there is a higher plane of consciousness, as well as the ordinary lower plane, and the master, by rising mentally to the higher plane, causes the swing of the mental pendulum to manifest on the lower plane. And he, dwelling on his higher plane, escapes the consciousness of the swing backward. This is effected by polarizing on the higher self, and thus raising the mental vibrations of the ego above those of the ordinary plane of consciousness. It is akin to rising above a thing and allowing it to pass beneath you. Oh, you mean like, are you telling me I can dodge bullets? No, I'm telling you, once you learn, you won't have to. Or whatever that shit was with the Matrix, remember that? The advanced Hermeticist polarizes himself at the positive pole of his being, the I am pole, rather than the pole of personality, and by refusing and denying the operation of rhythm, raises himself above its plane of consciousness, and standing firm in his statement of being, he allows the pendulum to swing back on the lower plane without changing his polarity. This is accomplished by all individuals who have attained any degree of self-mastery, whether they understand the law or not. Such persons simply refuse to allow themselves to be swung back by the pendulum of mood and emotion, and by steadfastly affirming the superiority, they remain polarized on the positive side. The master, of course, attains a far greater degree of proficiency because he understands the law which he is overcoming by a higher law, and by the use of his will, he attains a degree of poise and mental steadfastness almost impossible of belief on the part of those who allow themselves to be swung backward and forward by the mental pendulum of moods and feelings. Remember always, however, that you do not really destroy the principle of rhythm, for that is indestructible. You simply overcome one law by counterbalancing it with another and thus maintain an equilibrium. The laws of balance and counterbalance are in operation on the mental as well as on the physical planes. And an understanding of these laws enables one to seem to overthrow laws, whereas he is merely exerting a counterbalance. Nothing escapes the principle of cause and effect, but there are many planes of causation, and one may use the laws of the higher to overcome the laws of the lower. By an understanding of the practice of polarization, the Hermeticists rise to a higher plane of causation and thus counterbalance the laws of the lower planes of causation. By rising above the plane of ordinary causes, they become themselves, in a degree, causes instead of merely being caused. By being able to master their own moods and feelings, and by being able to neutralize rhythm, as we have already explained, they are able to escape a great part of the operations of cause and effect on the ordinary plane. The masses of people are carried along obedient to their environment, the wills and desires of others stronger than themselves, the effects of inherited tendencies, the suggestions of those about them, and other outward causes which tend to move them about on the chessboard of life like mere pawns. By rising above these influencing causes, the advanced Hermeticist seeks to a higher plane of mental action. And by dominating their moods, emotions, impulses, and feelings, they create for themselves new characters, qualities, and powers by which they overcome their ordinary environment, and thus become practically players instead of mere pawns. Such people help to play the game of life understandingly instead of being moved about this way and that way by stronger influences and powers and wills. They use the principle of cause and effect instead of being used by it. Of course, even the highest are subject to the principle as it manifests on the higher planes, but on the lower planes of activity, they are masters instead of slaves. As the Kabbalion says, the wise ones serve on the higher, but rule on the lower. They obey the laws coming from above them, but on their own plane and those below them, they rule and give orders. And yet in doing so, they form a part of the principle instead of opposing it. The wise man falls in with the law, and by understanding its movements, he operates it instead of being its blind slave. Just as the skilled swimmer turns this way and that way, going and coming as he will, instead of being as the log which is carried here and there, so is the wise man as compared to the ordinary man. And yet both swimmer and log, wise man and fool, are subject to law. He who understands this is well on the road to mastery. In conclusion, let us call again your attention to the Hermetic axiom. True Hermetic transmutation is a mental art. In the above axiom, the Hermeticists teach that the great work of influencing one's environment is accomplished by mental power. The universe being wholly mental, it follows that it may be ruled only by mentality. And in this truth is to be found an explanation of all the phenomenon and manifestations of the various mental powers which are attracting so much attention and study in these earlier years of the 20th century. Earlier years of the 20th century, wow. No wonder this a lot of this language sounds dated. Back of and under the teachings of the various cults and schools remains ever constant the principle of the mental substance of the universe. If the universe be mental in its substantial nature, then it follows that the mental transmutation must change the conditions and phenomenon of the universe. If the universe is mental, then mind must be the highest power affecting its phenomenon. If this be understood, then all the so-called miracles and wonder workings are seen plainly for what they are. And yeah, manifestation of the mind. And that's the end. The all is mind. The universe is mental. The Kabbalion, that's the last thing it says. So that's the end. And that's a great read. And